This is tape 3, the morning of February 2nd, 1961. Mr. President, in this last tape, you said that Roosevelt was already committed to Churchill. Now, what did you mean exactly by that?
Well, he was committed to the salvation of the free world, not only Churchill, but to France and all the rest of the countries that were anxious to escape the Nazi control of that part of the world. And
well, you think then he felt that he couldn't have kept out of the, that America could not have kept out of the Second World War?
No, because he didn't have a successor that could carry on as he was. As he did.
What about the critical and bitter charges against him that he plotted to bring America into the war?
I don't think he did. I think he did everything he possibly could to keep us out of the war.
But then you're taking the categorical position that he did not seek a third term. Events forced him into it.
That's what I say. That's exactly what I say. Same thing happened with the fourth term. And if the fourth term hadn't come about, I wouldn't have been president. I'd have been in the Senate and be there yet, where the happiest time of my life was spent.
Well, we won't share in that judgment because you had to be sacrificed. Tell us, Mr. President, do you consider Roosevelt among the very, very greatest presidents?
Yes, I think he's one of the five or six great presidents.
Well, may I break down that, Mr. President, to say, did you consider him a great administrator?
No, he was not a great administrator. He was a great executive. But he was not a good administrator.
Well, was he a man then with great imagination to lead the people?
That's right. That was one of his greatest assets, his ability to make the people believe that he was right.
And was he daring in what he had tried to do?
Yes, he was.
Well, wasn't he frequently accused of pussyfooting along on certain paths, or do you think that was a politician in him?
Well, he may have pussyfooted, but he accomplished the purpose to win the Second World War. And that's what all of us were interested in at that time.
So the two great things, in a sense, that he did was, first of all, to restore the economic situation in this country, and the second, to save the free world and win the Second World War.
Those were the two great things he did, beginning in 1933 and ending in 1945 when he died.
In other words, you can't say then that he was a great originator of ideas or a philosopher or any documents at all which made him, in the sense that Jefferson or others have been.
Well, Bill, we can't go into that because I'm not one either. But he was the man who caused the recovery from the terrible depression we had in 1929, 30, and 31. And he was the man who persisted in a manner which won the Second World War. And all that philosophical thing I can't talk about because I don't pay much attention to it.
That's right, Mr. President. I'm acting as a devil's advocate here.
I know you are, and you keep on. I like it.
But at any rate, there's one point I must disagree with your own version of yourself, because in your action in the Truman Doctrine, Greece and Turkey and the other things, you did something which was philosophically and from the point of view of American doctrine, you were invoking America's position in the world to a greater extent than it had ever been, even by Roosevelt during the war.
Well, that situation had to be met. The objective of the communists was, of course, to take over Greece and Turkey and Berlin, and it had to be met. And we met it as best we could. I was told that the airlift would not work in Berlin, but it did.
I think what we were trying to get at here, though, is whether, in your opinion, Franklin Roosevelt reactivated a good deal of the Woodrow Wilson program and put it into effect without contributing any great new concept of his own.
I think he reactivated the Woodrow Wilson program of League of Nations, when the United Nations program was set up, when he and Churchill met in Quebec and started the thing off. And I can't say whether he made any great contributions to it or not, but we got it set up.
Well, did Roosevelt change in any important essential the composition of the economy of the United States?
Well, yes, to some extent. He was of the opinion that the concentration of wealth in a few hands should be stopped. And that's what happened with all the program which he put through.
There was some very basic redistribution of wealth that took place during his administration.
There's no question about it, and it's still going on.
Do you feel that this was originated with him, or this was part of the Great Reformation that had to take place in the
industrial
economy?
Well, I think it was a part of the Great Reformation, but I think somebody had to put it into effect, and I think he did it.
So in that sense, you would mark Roosevelt as a man who was a great leader and a great Democratic president.
There isn't any question about it in my mind.
Would you then point out some of the important defects that you saw in Franklin Roosevelt as a president?
Well, every president has his defects, and it's a difficult thing.
Just for the record.
It's a difficult thing for a successor to try to make it appear that something better could have been done under the circumstances, because nobody, remember this, nobody knows all the facts on which a president makes his decisions. And if other decisions might have been better, they were Monday morning decisions after the fact. And I think he did the very best he could under the circumstances. And the only thing I'm sorry about is that his health failed, and he didn't live to the end of his fourth term.
Did he stretch the Constitution as violently as Lincoln did?
No. No, he didn't. Every president who has had to do things has had to interpret the Constitution in ways that are called stretching it. But Roosevelt didn't have to go as far as Lincoln did.
Things that you would associate with Roosevelt as being permanent additions to our kind of government would be what?
Well, all that series of programs which came about in what they call the first 100 days. Of course, a great many of those things were started by Woodrow Wilson in his first administration. But you'll find that the efforts to put an end to Social Security and other things of that sort have been failures. They've had to improve them rather than eliminate them under the Republican administration.
Mr. President, in his relation with the world and his action, I think I've heard you say that one of the greatest gifts that Winston Churchill had was Roosevelt. In other words, without Roosevelt, he could not have done anything despite his eloquence and brave words.
That's true. That's true. Roosevelt's support made Churchill great, and Churchill's support made Roosevelt great. So it was a mutual proposition.
Well, in that relationship, who influenced whom?
Nobody knows. Nobody knows. I think each had his influence on the other in a manner that was very helpful to the welfare of the world.
Now, Mr. President, both Churchill and Roosevelt for a time attempted to do something with Hitler, despite their knowledge that there was a great basic difference between them. Roosevelt sent men over there to talk to Hitler, and Churchill himself had written favorably about Hitler. Do you think that was an effort of good men to bring about some solution without war, or do you think it was blindness?
I think it was an effort to save what eventually came about. I think both Roosevelt and Churchill were anxious to prevent a Second World War, and that their efforts failed. And they failed because Hitler was, let's say, a damn fool. If he'd had sense enough to go along with them and had sense enough to accept the chance he had in the Ukraine when the Russians in the Ukraine wanted to join him, there might not have been any Second World War. But the two men we're talking about, Roosevelt and Churchill, were doing everything they possibly could to keep a Second World War from coming about. They didn't succeed, and we won the war, so why argue about
how, well, accepting that, how could you assess the greatness of these two men, Roosevelt and Churchill, and you had Stalin on the other side, and this fanatic grew right up under their noses, and they were sucked in. They never made one move to stop him.
The reason he grew up under their noses is because Stalin made a deal with him. And if Stalin hadn't made that deal and stayed with his friends, there wouldn't have been any Second World War.
Oh, but by
he went over to he went over and met this guy and made a deal with him. And then, as soon as the time became ripe for Hitler to knock his ears down, he went back on the deal. But Stalin didn't stay with his friends.
But by that time, he was caught in the net, too. He moved only because he had to have time, like Chamberlain had to have time. What I was trying to get at is how, with all this ability, this crazy man was able to get as far as he did and kept right on going.
Because up to that, at the time you're talking about, France had folded up. Holland, Belgium, all Western Europe had folded up. And Stalin then made a deal with Hitler. And I don't know how Churchill, all by himself on that little island across the English Channel, could have done anything only what he did do.
What I was trying to get at is how this great Franklin Roosevelt, from 33 on, and Hitler was already beginning to show some very, very strong outcroppings then. What happened between 33 and 40?
Well, Stalin surrendered. And his deal with Hitler, the downfall of France. France was the greatest fall down that could happen at that time. Had France stood up, there might have been a different story, but France didn't.
Well, then nobody could prevent it then. That's what you're saying, in effect, is nobody could have prevented it.
No. No, I don't think could.
Well, may I ask this? What do you think Roosevelt's estimate of Stalin was? Do you think he was correct in estimating? Wasn't he somewhat fooled and later disheartened by Stalin?
I don't think so. I don't think Stalin became a menace until after the Potsdam conference. Before that, he'd been the friend of the West at Casablanca, at Cairo, at Tehran, and finally at Yalta. And the only reason for the Potsdam Conference was to implement the agreements that had been made at Yalta.
This is tape 3, the morning of February the 2nd. This is tape 4, the morning of February 2nd, 1961. Mr. President, you say that Stalin became unfriendly and wrong immediately after the Potsdam Conference.
That's true.
What do you attribute that to?
Well, he had come to the conclusion that he was in a position where he could gain his objectives without the help of the West. And that's what brought it about.
Well, do you feel that that Potsdam was the point of demarcation for the
yes.
big policy of Russia?
Potsdam was a call for the purpose of implementing the agreements that had been made with Russia beginning in Quebec way early in the game, when at that period the arrangement in Germany had been made. And when the Potsdam Conference was over and everything had been agreed to, and everybody ought to read that protocol at Potsdam, they ought to read the protocol at Yalta, and you'll find that all of us had confidence that Stalin would keep his engagements. After Potsdam, he began to break every engagement he'd made. He broke 20 engagements with Roosevelt, and he broke 32 with me. And I don't know how you're going to decide on what'll happen when a man doesn't keep his engagements. That's always the trouble.
But the Russian program had always been diametrically opposed to the program of the West, so in a sense, until the war came along, there was conflict between the two. There was never any friendly relationship.
Not any serious conflict after the Germans had approached within reach of Moscow and Leningrad. And the objective then of the Russians was to get with the people who could save them, and we did save them. And the result was that after it was all over, they decided they saved themselves. And like every person you help when he's down and he gets up and gets working on a basis where he thinks he did it himself, the Russians had the same result. Now, we sent equipment, $6.5 billion worth of equipment, through the Caspian Sea and the Persian Gulf, so that the Russians were saved. Had it not been for that approach, the Russians would have been pulverized by Hitler. And if Hitler had succeeded in pulverizing the Russians at the time he had a chance to do it, where would we be?
Well, but then you don't hold with the opinion that so many people have held in retrospect that we had made a mistake in coming to the help of Russia?
No, we had to help Russia to save ourselves. That's the only reason we did it.
What was, there's been a good deal of criticism about Roosevelt at Yalta. What is your feeling about that?
Well, my feeling is that everybody ought to read the protocol and agreement that was made at Yalta, and then read the protocol and agreement that was made at Potsdam, and you find that they were both all right. At Russia have kept its agreements. That's all of us doing.
And there was no indication at all at the time that Russia might not keep the agreements.
No, there wasn't. You have to believe somebody, and Stalin was speaking for Russia. And he was not a hard man to make an agreement with, but I found afterwards that the reason he was easy enough to make an agreement with, he didn't intend to keep the agreements.
Well, certainly Churchill, who was a critical leader of Russia, certainly he was willing to make agreements.
He was there and made them in both instances. And he thought they were all right, and so did I. So did anybody else who was there.
Well, you met Roosevelt immediately after he got back from the Yalta and made arrangements for his appearance on the Hill.
That's right.
Well, he was pretty well done in, and at that time he showed signs of discouragement about his relations and experience with Stalin.
I don't think he showed any serious discouragement. He showed his physical deterioration and weakness. I don't think he was in any way. I talked to him before he went down there, and I don't think he was in any way of the opinion that Stalin wouldn't keep his agreements. And of course, I went to Potsdam with that idea in mind after I talked to him.
You don't think that his appearance on the Hill left some people with the feeling that he hadn't fared so well in his negotiations?
No, I don't. I think he made a good deal at Yalta.
Why was it necessary for a president of the United States in his frail condition, if we were doing so well with him, to go all the way to Yalta to meet Stalin?
Because that had been the policy right along. He'd been to Casablanca, he'd been to Tehran, he'd been to Cairo, and this was a continuation of an effort to get world peace. That's all there was to it.
Would you have gone there had you been president at that time?
Under the circumstances, I would have.
To accommodate Stalin?
No, to accommodate myself and get peace in the world. He didn't go to accommodate Stalin. He went with the idea that he was going to win a world peace under the United Nations at work. That's all he went
to enlist Stalin's support, so there was a problem in getting him to join up.
We had to have Stalin's support. I had to send a man to Stalin to make Molotov agree to the United Nations Charter after it was made up.
Why was it so hard to get him to work with us then, if we were getting along?
Because he thought he was independent, he was out of danger, and he could do as he damn pleased. That's all the trouble.
So when you went to Potsdam, you weren't too sure that everything was in shipshape order with Russia.
No, I went there with the hope that it would be in shipshape when it got through, and I thought it was. And so did everybody else that was there.
As a matter of fact, you went out of your way to see that no agreement made by Churchill and Roosevelt were modified unilaterally.
That's right. That's right. That's what I went for, was to get the confirmation of what had been done in the four meetings previous to Potsdam.
Well, of course, you never can unscramble history, but you think then that what went wrong, in effect, was that Stalin and Russia began to feel independent of all the help they got and intended to become a power in its own right.
Well, yes, I think they decided it wasn't necessary to keep the agreements. And had we not effectively met them in Berlin, in Greece and Turkey, and in the Near East, we would have been in a bad fix. They had agreed to withdraw their troops from Azerbaijan in Iran, and didn't do it. So we ordered a fleet in the Persian Gulf and told them we were sending a division. Then they moved out. Same thing happened with Tito at Trieste when he made up his mind that he was going to take over Trieste after all these things took place. And I sent him word, all right, come on, we had divisions and a fleet there to meet him. And he didn't come. That's the only language they understand.
Well, is it fair to ask you whether you felt that you were more alerted and more aware historically of Russia's intent to dominate the world than your predecessor was?
I don't. Yes, I think I was, because he felt like a great many people of that period that our strength and ability would hold the Russians in check, and that they would be glad to get along with us. But when they found that they thought they could do as they pleased, then they started to do it, and we just put a stop to it. But I think Roosevelt's idea of the whole situation was that he had made the agreement with Russia that would stick. After my trip to Potsdam, I never thought so.
When did you discover that this was all going to go down the drain?
When the Russians tried to move into Greece and Turkey and Berlin. That was the period when I made up my mind you couldn't trust them.
Well, wasn't it a little sooner, because when Stalin failed to implement the Potsdam Agreements with regard to the satellite states, that's when you began to first...
So we began to worry about it, but the actual facts took place when they refused to carry out the agreements with us, which they had made with regard to these
satellite states.
Specific things that I'm telling you about. That was Berlin and Greece and Turkey. And, of course, in the satellite states, that situation had developed while we were at Potsdam. And that was just the beginning. The whole thing was added to by Azerbaijan and his disagreement with getting out of the Caspian Sea area.
The Polish situation was the first one that gave the real indication that they meant no good.
Well, Poland and Romania and Bulgaria, they were all in the same place, and all happened at the same time.
There was then a government in exile in Poland, which they...
That's right.
But then you yourself have stated that the very fact that the Russians were making difficulty in Berlin, you decided you didn't want them in the occupation of Japan and moved
Japanese treaties Japanese surrender came about, I made it a point to be careful to keep them out of Japan on account of the way they'd acted in the other places in Western Europe.
Of course, both you and Roosevelt realized that without the participation of Russia, there could not be United Nations, and that would be the...
That's true, and without the participation of Russia, we couldn't have won the war. If they'd stayed with Hitler, and Hitler had been smart, there wouldn't have been any chance to win the war in Western Europe.
You don't believe that. Without Russia, that the Allies couldn't have mustered even at a later date enough power to stem the tide.
Russia had 7 million men in the field, and we only had 1,600,000. Do your own figuring.
That little country stood off the rest of the world a second time?
That's right.
So, with all the mobilization and all this tremendous industrial might that the United States was able to turn on, we couldn't have done it unless Russia were at the other end.
Unless Russia was on our side. It couldn't have been won.
Is that because Japan was in the picture, or would it have...
No. Japan had nothing to do with it. We hooked Japan after that.
What you're saying, in effect, is the second time around, the free world could not have licked Germany.
That's correct. If Hitler had used sense, we never could have whipped him.
Well, the fact was, of course, that...
He whipped France and all Western Europe. And then he went crazy.
Well, of course, he took one at a time. There was no organization.
If he'd stayed out of Russia, he'd had the world but the tail. Because he had a deal with Russia.
This was the big mistake, was the Napoleonic mistake again. Well,
That's it.
Well, of course, he had tried for a number of years before he actually moved to get an agreement with England, but he never got anywhere at all.
I don't think he really tried. I don't think he liked England. They've always been afraid of England. All that continental outfit's been afraid of England. But then when Hitler upset his agreement with Russia, that's when it became late.
Well, just to wind it up, do you feel we're anywhere near a solution of this very, very deadly conflict between the East and the West?
Well, I hope we are, but then it's a long ways off.
What is it going to take?
Leadership on both sides.
Well, this gives us a little side glance at your immediate successor.
Well, you never can tell. The situation has developed to the point where both sides are afraid of total destruction. Situation in 1941.
I think we are now at the stalemate which may put off the conflict for some time.
I hope we are.
This is the end of tape four. It's the end of tape four, the morning of February 2nd.
We'll play some more.